Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The consequences of the control of reproduction and the reproduction of daily life that began about the time of the creation of the movable type printing press in approximately the year 1440 is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. Our guest is Dr. Sally Roche Wagner, the founding director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage Foundation in Fayetteville, New York, and a member of the adjunct faculty at Syracuse University in Syracuse, New York. Sally Roche Wagner was one of the first of two women to receive a doctorate for work in women's studies, with a PhD awarded to her in 1978 from the History of Consciousness program by the University of California at Santa Cruz. Wagner, a Radio Curious veteran guest, is now the author of Survival is Indigenous, a book that describes the consequences of the societal control shortly after the development of the printing press, fomented by Western religions, which she argues exists to the present time. Sally Roche Wagner and I visited in the Radio Curious studios on January 6, 2016, to discuss Survival is Indigenous, and began our conversation when I asked her, what is indigenous about survival?
We are at the tail end of a 500-year experiment in the West, in patriarchal Christian capitalism, whatever name we call it. I'm sort of dating it from the moment of the printing press, which took ideas almost what at that point was globally, and also the issuing of papal bulls, the doctrine of discovery papal bulls that said that if land was not inhabited by Christians, it was not inhabited. And if people were not Christian, they could be enslaved. And so the religious underpinnings of the institution of slavery and land grab became religiously institutionalized around the time that Columbus appears.
My understanding of that is the Intercetera Bull.
Yes. The fact that it's still used in U.S. law is the foundation. The Sherrill case in 2004, where Ruth Bader Ginsburg begins the majority opinion with citing the doctrine of discovery. So those were issued at the same time that papal bulls were issued calling for the extermination of the witches. And the worst sin of the witches was interrupting birth in any way. And I think that the effects of those still today, legally, both of those papal bulls, the disruption in reproductive justice that is religiously based has its foundation in the time of those papal bulls, if we go back far enough. That creation of an ideology that is controlling both reproduction and the reproduction of daily life. If you control those two things, you're really controlling survival. The reproduction of daily life is integral to the earth. So you have a system that is about controlling those, not living in harmony with or working with. And that's in opposition to an indigenous system, which predates Christianity, predates those papal bulls, and continues to be in existence in modified forms due to colonization around the world, but still exists. And those two competing systems are really the moral showdown that we're facing right now in the world.
Can you describe the other system? The one in which the papal bulletins or bulls is in contrast with?
Mm-hmm. The indigenous understanding of the world and being in the world, as far as I can understand it as a non-native person, is based on relationship. It's based on connection with the earth. It's has a foundation in a belief that the earth and everything in it is in contrast to the Christian system of the earth being the, you know, dirt is as low as you can get, and the true spirituality exists in heaven, it exists off the earth. The spiritual foundation of indigenous thought and belief is the earth. The earth and everything on it has a sacredness to it, not an evil. And a relationship of all life, the integral connection of all life, is another foundation principle that seems to be shared by indigenous people generally.
When you say that shared by indigenous people, is that worldwide, or are we talking about indigenous people who prior to civilization were generally characterized as nomadic, and in some cases in some parts of the world now still are nomadic?
Well, nomadic, I think, is determined by the geography of the place. In Mexico, but 4,000 years before Christ, women invented corn. Corn is not a natural occurring substance. It was created. And the system of basic food elements being corn, bean, and squash, which are both nutritionally perfect food group. You know, if you eat just corn, beans, and squash, you can exist indefinitely on those three forms. The Haudenosaunee call them the three sisters. But those were cultivated from South to North America before Columbus and adapted to each climate and became the basis of food for each of those areas, for all of those areas. And they're also environmentally perfect. The corn raises tall and provides a twining place for the beans to reach the sunlight. The squash leaves cover the mound. These are planted in mounds. And the squash leaves are sticky and they're brittle. You don't want to walk on them if you're a bird or an animal. They also provide a sort of microculture where they keep the soil moist and they keep it at a good temperature. And the beans set the nitrates in the soil for the corn. There are milpas in Mexico that have been cultivated for 4,000 years. The biblical edict that one must plant a single crop resulted in a Western form of crop cultivation that is single crop, and we know the results of that today ecologically. You know, and you have to keep poisoning the earth to get it to produce more and more, and that poison spreads all the way through the water systems. It's a non-sustainable system of agriculture. I think in referring to indigenous people, I'm really looking to their direction in the definition of themselves. Original Instructions is a book that is very valuable in looking at. It was done by the group Bioneers, and it really brings together, it's one of the examples of the ways in which indigenous people worldwide now are gathering for conferences on how to create the survival of life on the planet. They are in touch with each other and finding the similarities in their value systems. So it's really taking direction from indigenous people, their understanding of who they are.
In preparing your work, your research for survival as indigenous, what did you do?
This is about 40 years of research. It really began when I was trying to figure out how this woman, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who got written out of history, developed such an inclusive and a visionary understanding of what change needed to be made.
The title of your book, Survival is Indigenous, in a way to me sounds like it's a directive. It is how to survive where we are confronted worldwide with climate change, which is going to make survival much more difficult. What are some of the other elements of indigenous survival that you propose that to be adapted by cultures around the world now in 2016?
Well, as I was looking, I was really looking just at, okay, what are the essences of survival? And it seemed to me that they're really reproduction and the reproduction of daily life. The reproduction of daily life is totally tied to the earth. It has to do with how we eat, how we heal ourselves, and, you know, how we clothe, how we shelter, all of that. And birth is who controls the relations of reproduction and how does reproduction occur? And so it seemed to me to look at those was to begin to look at how do we ensure survival? And looking at all of those, I was looking at how the influence of in each of those areas of indigenous people on people in North America through contact. And what I found was that there were these waves of indigenizing that we would go through as a culture, non-native culture, that we'd see how this was an effective way and we'd adopt different ways of birthing, we'd adopt different ways of agriculture, we'd adopt different ways of clothing, and then we'd revert back. And, you know, once again, I mean, women are in high heels, they're in totally sexualized clothing. We've reverted back again from the dress reform movement in the 70s. And so how do we finally re-indigenize? And how do we ultimately change permanently the way that we approach the earth, the way that we approach our relationships? And it seemed to me that that really is the spiritual and the moral foundation, and that the competing moral systems of the Christianity, which, okay, this is post-God time, but the science that we have is based on control. It's not based on a sense of this has an absolute sanctity of life. It's based on I'm going to figure out how best to control this whatever it is form of life, whether it's we genetically modify seeds or whether it's we, you know, cut down rainforests without any sense of what's going on to the animals there.
So the question is, how do we indigenize? That's the bigger question in your book, Survival is Indigenous. The short answer is?
We change our moral system to one in which we value not power and control, but one in which we value relationship, our relationship to every living thing, and our relationship to the earth.
Sally Rose Wagner, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, has been a guest many times on Radio Curious in the past. And I would like to draw your attention to the interview with Matilda Jocelyn Gage as portrayed by Sally Rose Wagner, which may be found on the Radio Curious website, radiocurious.org. And you are listening to Radio Curious. We're visiting with Sally Rose Wagner about her pending book, Survival is Indigenous. I'm Barry Vogel. Sally, tell us more about the connection of your original work that involved Matilda Jocelyn Gage.
The connection with Matilda, she was adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation. She wrote about the superior position of Haudenosaunee or Iroquois women, and that was her vision of how the world should be structured, was an indigenous vision. And it's a very woman-honoring cultural experience. It's egalitarian. It's based on balance, not equality. Equality is what you talk about in the absence of it. But once you have equality, the function is to maintain the balance and the harmony. And that is, I think, at the essence of indigenous cultures as well, not just the Haudenosaunee. But I started out trying to figure out what the heck she's talking about with the Haudenosaunee. She says, never was justice more perfect, never was civilization higher. Well, this should catch the attention of an observer. And so I spent a number of years going back to the earliest contact records and looking at how did white people see indigenous people. And the results have been just astounding to me. I've worked endlessly to try to find an indigenous culture where violence against women was a commonplace, as it is in our culture. And I couldn't find a single one. The times when violence would occur, it was dealt with very harshly. Among the Haudenosaunee, for a clan mother to choose a chief, he cannot have committed a theft, he cannot have committed a murder, and he cannot have abused a woman. Those are the requirements.
And it was the clan mother of the Haudenosaunee who chose the chief.
Who chooses still today.
And is
and
the chief...
places the chief in position. The mothers raise these. The grandmothers are watching these boys as they come up. And they see whose calling might be. It's not the man who puts himself forward. It's not the boy who's out for himself. It's the little boy who's in the background watching to see what everybody needs and making sure they get it. And she nurtures this child, and ultimately, if this is the calling of this child, the child becomes as an adult.
Are girls chosen to be chief?
Girls choose the chief.
But why are they not chosen to be chief?
That's a question of equality. That comes from a Western system of thought that says everyone should be equal to do everything. If you have a biologically based system that says women reproduce, men don't. That's a difference. Women are responsible for everything in the earth. That's why women were the agriculturalists. Women are responsible for determining what men should be making the decisions. They counsel the men. They have the responsibility to remove the men from office. That's the men's responsibility, to listen to the women and to be the decision makers based on consensus. But it's a system of balance. It's not a system of inequality. It's a system of balance where each have their own responsibilities. If you look at it in terms of equality, what it looks like is women have more power than men. And when I've talked to Haudenosaunee women and men about that, they poo-poo the idea. You know, this is not about power. This is not about who's ruling who. This is about creating a balance, a system of responsibilities.
The only difference that I heard you just identify is that women reproduce and men do not. Mm-hmm. What is your understanding as to why that is a reason why the women choose the chief who is a male as opposed to choosing a chief who would be a female?
The women choose the chief among the Haudenosaunee, as I understand it, because in the story of the creation of the Confederacy, the peacemaker who came at a time when there was terrible strife, I mean, there was cannibalism, there were people killing each other, and the peacemaker came, and the first person to hear the message of peace was Jingo Sase, a woman. And so the peacemaker said, women will have the responsibility for holding the position of the sachem, and they will be the ones who will determine who will be the person to represent their clan. But the way that the Haudenosaunee folks that I have talked to have explained it to me is that the clan mother sits with the chief and counsels the chief, and the decisions are really made together. But he's the spokesperson. He's the one who sits in council. She's out in the field traditionally. The woman's responsibility was agriculture because women and Mother Earth are seen as inseparable, that Earth is the ultimate mother and sustains all of us.
And what is the responsibility of the men who are not chosen to be chief?
The men are responsible for everything traditionally, this is pre-contact, for everything on the earth. And so their responsibility is hunting, their responsibility is preparing the land for the women to do the agriculture, like they'll girdle the trees and remove the trees if the women need more room for planting.
When you say pre-contact, my understanding is that is generally presumed to be contact with European people. Mm-hmm. So let's get back to your pending book, Survival is Indigenous.
Let me tell you, I could not find in the literature experiences of violence against women, sexual, physical violence against women or children, that when they occurred were not dealt with very harshly. Among the Lakota, for example, the story of the white buffalo calf woman. This is the woman who brings the spiritual ceremonies to the Lakota. And she appears first as a white buffalo, and then as she gets closer, she turns into this beautiful young woman who's in white buckskin. And there are two scouts that are out looking for buffalo that she encounters. One of them has intentions, bad intentions, and starts coming toward her. She says, "Come to me with whatever is in your heart." And he comes at her, and there's a cloud that engulfs them. And when the cloud disappears, he's a skeleton on the ground with worms crawling through it. The second scout is respectful of her, and she says to him, "Go to your people and tell them I'll be there, I think, in 5 days. So he goes back, and they prepare themselves, and she comes and brings the ceremonies. Now, what do you think that kind of spiritual grounding is compared to the story of Eve, who brings knowledge into the world, and as a result, women are to be under the authority of men and suffer in childbirth? You know, this is an indeterminate sentence. It doesn't end with Eve. Women are burned as witches in the Middle Ages by the church because they relieve the pains of childbirth. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton says at one point, "Why should only Christian women suffer in childbirth?" There's a missionary in the 1600s who says, well, the reason I think that women don't suffer, these Indian women give birth so easily. I mean, what's going on here? Our women are laying in pain and misery. What's the difference? And he said, the difference is they haven't yet gotten the gospel of Christ. So they don't know they're supposed to suffer in childbirth. But there's this constant thing going on around birth. So I'm looking at birth and finding that here are white people saying, look it, Indian women are birthing very differently than we do. They birth in a different position. They don't experience what we're experiencing. So let's learn from them. Food. White people were eating salt pork and drinking corn whiskey. In Syracuse, for example, you know, the average lifespan was 50, 60. Aunt Dinah is, the newspapers report, maybe she's 120, and she's still walking to Syracuse every day. She's coming from Onondaga Nation. How do these people live twice as long as we live? What's the difference? And so the food reform movement springs up, and people start eating whole grains, start being unafraid of raw vegetables, which they thought had to be cooked to smithereens before they could eat them. And they start eating more healthy, and they start living longer. Dress reform. Women were corseting to 18-inch waists and had all kinds of physical problems, died in childbirth because their vital organs had been displaced. And they are right next door to and know women who are wearing loose-fitting tunics with leggings. The very first reform costume wasn't the bloomer. It was the women in the Oneida community, which was a utopian community, and they were wearing leggings.
And what year was this?
1848. Same year as the Seneca Falls Convention, they developed this reform costume.
Well, Sally Rose Wagner, I again want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you share with us a eureka or an aha moment that changed your life?
I think a eureka moment would be that moment when I finally saw in Matilda Jocelyn Gage's book, Woman, Church, and State, never was justice more perfect, never was civilization higher. Because for the last 40 years, it's been the major business of my life to try to figure out what the heck she meant by that. And this new book is a result of the closest I have at this point to an answer.
And what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life.
The truth is that I think that the most important voices for us to listen to right now, in terms of the most important question before us, which is whether or not life will survive on the planet, the voices that we need to listen to most are the voices of Indigenous women. And the work that I see myself doing that I most feel committed to is to work as a bridge, an opening act, if you will, so that if my work can open the eyes and ears of non-Indigenous people to listening to the real experts on survival, that's what I want to do.
And finally, Sally Rose Wagner, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
You know what I just finished reading was Gloria Steinem's On the Road. And it is, for anyone who was involved in the women's rights movement in the early days, for anyone who has an interest in that, or for anyone who really just wants a good read about the life of an iconic woman, I highly recommend that book.
Sally Wagner, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Barry, it's always a pleasure.
Dr. Sally Rose Wagner is the author of Survival is Indigenous, a book that describes the consequences of the societal control that began shortly after the development of the printing press, subsequently fomented by Western religion, which she argues exists to the present time. Her website is sallyroeschwagner.com. Roche is spelled R-O-E-S-C-H. The books that Dr. Wagner recommends are Braiding Sweetgrass, Indigenous Wisdom, Scientific Knowledge, and the Teaching of Plants by Robin Will Kimmerer, and My Life on the Road by Gloria Steinem. This program was recorded on January 6th, 2016. Radio Curious has over 600 archive editions on our website, radiocurious.org, with new editions published regularly. You may stream, download, subscribe to our podcast service, and share them as you wish. They're all free. We appreciate your thoughts, ideas, and comments about our programs and enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The phone is 707-462-6541, and the address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. Christina Onnested and Yuko Kodama are the assistant producers. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.